You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Friday the 20th of January. Ko Amanda Robinson, toko ingoa. My name's Amanda Robinson. I'm joined in studio by producer John Michael Swanix. Hi, John Michael.
Hiya, good to be here. Very good.
That's good. On the show today, we'll be talking about a new issue of a journal about civic, citizenship and political literacy. As usual, we'll also be talking to National's Jamie Lee Ross about inequality after the release of the Oxfam report, Waitangi Day and Bill English's travels. We'll have Professor Andrew Geddes from Otago University about the apocalypse, no, about the inauguration of Donald Trump tomorrow. And like every week, we'll also have Neighbourhood Watch for all the latest in Australian news. Finishing off the show today, we're going to be hearing about New Zealand's long history of getting in Israel's bad side after our vote at the UN recently. And first up, Green Party MP Julianne Genta recently announced she'd be standing in the Mount Albert by-election against Labour MP Jacinda Ardern. Another candidate who's received less attention is Socialist Joe Carolan. BFM reporter Lillian Hanley spoke to him about why he's standing the challenge and the challenges that he faces.
I'm a local. I live in the area for the last 12 years. My kids go to school there. My partner works with the Play Centre and with the local eco-neighbourhood group in Owaraka. So I suppose the reason I'm standing is as a local activist. I work with Unite Union. We fight for low-paid workers. Last year we helped to defeat the zero hours contracts. So that's a testimony to how people power can change things. And I think a lot of people are getting switched off from mainstream politics, not only here in New Zealand, but internationally, as we've seen with like things like Brexit and Trump, because they feel that either it's something that's stitched up by the big parliamentary parties, or that the issues that they talk about have nothing to do with the ordinary lives that a lot of people are trying to survive in. And I think we should have a choice. There was a bit of an argument that no one should stand in this election, that National Party, for example, are not putting forward a candidate for their people to vote for. I think we have too little democracy in society, and we need more democracy. We need daily democracy. We need democracy in our workplace. And I'm standing as a radical alternative in the area, someone who stands for people power and for workers' rights.
So if you running as sort of like an independent, if you win this, you become an MP?
I'm standing as a socialist. I'm with a political party called Socialist Aotearoa.
Right.
But there's many left-wing groups on the left. I think that there's space to the left of Labour and the Greens here in New Zealand. The problem with politics is I think it's become very professional. It's by and large dominated by kind of liberal middle-class people. There's very few working-class voices anymore. And if you look back to the kind of golden age in New Zealand in the 30s and 40s, where Labour was very strong, where there were significant changes to social housing, state homes being built, wages increasing, that was when you had a lot of working class voices within the Labour movement. And that's an argument, a discussion I want to have with the bigger parties.
Mm.
I actually believe that we need an alternative economic system. I don't want to reform capitalism. I don't want to tame it. I think we want to replace capitalism. We've about 10 years left on this planet to stop destroying it. And we've got an economic system that's addicted to profit, addicted to pollution. It needs to be ended, not reformed.
And by going into Parliament with that conversation, you think you'll be able to do that without a reform?
It would be very nice if I got elected to Parliament. But at this stage, I think I've got more modest goals. I want to see if there's 1,000 or 2,000 people in Mount Albert who agree with socialist politics, who agree that we need a radical change. And that would be a good base to start that work from. I also want to open up the discussion that we do need a strong working class left-wing party in New Zealand. And that could be formed with lots of other groups and unions. I was with the MANA movement. I think the MANA movement is very good and important part of political life in New Zealand. It's right that it's Māori-led, that Tangata Whenua have their own voice in New Zealand. However, MANA doesn't have any plans this year to stand any candidates in the general election seats. And so for migrant workers, for poor working class Pakeha people or Pacifica people, I think they'll be searching for a vehicle to register their anger through. And if you like, this kind of by-election standing as a socialist, kind of starting a bigger discussion about, is there space for a radical alternative in New Zealand, like we see elsewhere throughout the West rising.
So it's about pushing that movement and creating space for it to be talked about.
Yeah, and I mean, it's also very necessary that you have a radical alternative on the left. I mean, as the liberal politicians of the centre refuse to deal with the real problems working class people are faced with, be it low pay, be it 0 hours, be it living in garages, be it homelessness, high rents, etc. You know, the anger that people feel is not going to stay bottled up, or it's not going to be patronized by liberals for too much longer. And the danger is that unless you have a left-wing alternative that correctly says that your problems are caused by an economic system dominated by the rich, by the 1%, by these two individuals, for example, in New Zealand who own more than 30% of the wealth of the country, you know, what a disgusting, unequal country we are becoming. If you don't have a radical left-wing point of view pointing to that problem, I think what you're seeing around the world is the reemergence of a radical right-wing alternative that takes the anger that working class people feel, but instead of putting that anger towards the economic system, it starts to scapegoat gay people, it starts to scapegoat migrants like myself, starts to scapegoat people of colour and say, we need to round these people up, we need to get rid of them, we need to build a wall, we need to send them home in trains. You know, we've seen what happened in the 1930s, and that is a danger as the centre in political life collapses.
Mm. Just on that point about Julianne Genta and Jacinda Ardern being the other two main candidates, there was that Herald article saying that they are essentially the only candidates, really. What do you think about that in terms of how the media actually doesn't allow for that space either?
Well, what would you expect from the New Zealand Herald? You know? the Herald is the boss's paper, you know, the Queen Street Gazette. Very few working class voices are actually readers of it anymore, with exceptions. Journalists are individuals. Simon Collins is an excellent journalist who's actually covered some of the union fights and the housing struggles that we've been part of on the ground. But the media is by and large run for profits. They're corporations themselves. It's no wonder that they just create space for establishment voices and don't give alternative voices to fair go. And look, I'm wise to that. I know about that. However, I think in this campaign, we're going to be doing a number of actions which I think will get some breakthrough, some cut through, and they're around the real issues that the establishment parties are not dealing with adequately. I would have loved to see Labour Party flags and Green Party flags this Monday out in Glen Innes to stop Nikki being evicted, you know, a 62-year-old woman who's suffering from cancer, who's facing an eviction in Glen Innes. There's hundreds of column inches from Labour and the Greens and other parties in these newspapers every month. But where are they on the ground when working class people are facing eviction or where they're on strike? I think we need to worry less about Parliament. We need to worry more about the workplaces and the streets that we live in. And that's why I want to be a strong voice for people in Mount Albert.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
That was BFM reporter Lillian Hanley talking to socialist candidate in the Mount Albert by-election, Joe Carolyn. Remember, if you have anything you'd like to add throughout the show, what you think of anything, give us a text on 5395. Next up, we have National MP Jamie Lee Ross talking with me and John Michael. Good afternoon, Jamie Lee.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. How are you? Happy New Year.
I'm doing well. Good to be back.
Yeah, for sure. That's good. So, first up today, I wanted to ask you about what you think of the Oxfam report and the inequality is kind of expanding more and more.
Sure. Oxfam's making an argument. I think when they talk about, you know, some very wealthy individuals that have been successful in international businesses overseas, it's a bit hard to make the argument just using those people. Yes, there is inequality between sectors in society, and the role of government is to try and help to educate people, help to ensure there's housing for people, help to ensure there are more jobs being created in the economy, so that those people who need help the most and are down the bottom end do have future opportunities. And so I'm not going to say that there's no inequality. I'd be lying if I was saying that. But the important thing is that we help those people get educated, be healthy, get jobs. And I think New Zealand has been seeing progress in that regard in the past 8 years. There are more jobs in the economy. Education rates have lifted. Overall, the health system is delivering healthier outcomes for people. And so we need to keep doing things like that to help people improve their lot in life.
And what, Jamie Lee, it's John Michael here. What would you say to the people who are saying that it's been worsening under the national government over the last 8 to 9 years?
Well, I'd say to them that there are more kids being educated. NCA Level 2 results have increased to, from sort of mid-60s to mid-80s now. There's the opportunity for kids to have free doctor's visits if they're under 13. We've increased benefit payments to families by $25 a week. Any school that wants to have breakfast in school, we provide that. We've insulated state housing. I think there's something like 250,000 new jobs that's been created in the economy in the past 3 years. Those are the things that matter to people. Having a job, ensuring their kids get an education, ensuring they're healthy and they have a house to live in, those are the key essentials that government should be helping with where there's a need, and we're doing that.
That $25 benefit, of course it's helpful, but how, I mean, with inflation over the last 9 years, does that really compare?
No, the benefits have been increasing with inflation throughout the period of time that there's been the benefit in place. This is the first real increase since 1972. The benefits had normally been inflation adjusted. This was an additional increase, the first time since 1972. And look, you might say for people that are earning quite a bit of money, they might look at that and say $25 isn't a lot. But for someone who's really living in difficult circumstances, who's on a benefit, who wants to try and provide more for their family, that $25 a week is quite a big increase for them, first time since 1972.
But if you think about, for example, $25, could you do it? Do you think that you could make ends meet if you were at the bottom of that ladder there and you had just only an extra $25?
Well, it's $25 they didn't have before. It's $25 a week, which adds up. What's more important, though, is that we help people move off a benefit and move into jobs by helping them to increase their education opportunities, by helping them to reduce drug and alcohol dependency if they've got difficulties there, by helping them with childcare support. We've increased the childcare ECE budget considerably as well. Those are the things that we should be doing, and those are the things that will make a real difference in their life. The long-term welfare liability or bill for the country has reduced by $10 billion since we've been in office. The reason why it's reduced is because fewer people are on a benefit, more people are getting jobs, more kids are being educated. We're seeing the prison system is helping to rehabilitate people more so that they're getting into jobs once they leave prison. Those are the things which I think we can point to and say New Zealanders have better opportunities now than they did 8 years ago.
All right, next I'd like to talk to you about Prime Minister Bill English's first overseas trip as in his capacity as Prime Minister. How did that go, and how is the post-Brexit New Zealand's trade relations with the EU and UK? What's your kind of opinion on that?
I think it's a positive move for the Prime Minister to go overseas. We've got a new Prime Minister now. He needs to establish relationships that he hasn't had previously. John Key and Murray McCulley obviously have the best relationships in the government in the international sphere. So having the new Prime Minister going to Europe, where we really need to press for greater opportunities for trade and try and progress an EU free trade agreement, I think that's been positive. So he met with Theresa May, met with Angela Merkel, he met with people within the European Union. Hopefully that will lead to better trading opportunities. The European Union said that they will be looking to move things along as fast as they can. We've just got to keep helping and pushing that as much as we can.
And did Bill English, did he push for greater rights for Kiwis in the UK? There's been a lot of contention around that recently.
I saw some reports that did come up, and he would have pushed it. Whenever a Prime Minister or a Foreign Minister meets with foreign leaders, there's always a range of topics they want to raise, and for any New Zealand leader visiting the UK, that's certainly on the agenda. Of course, what decision gets made is up to the UK government, not our government, but we certainly think there should be greater rights, and the Prime Minister pushed that.
Absolutely. And finally, I'd like to know your opinion on Prime Minister Bill English deciding not to attend the Waitangi Day ceremony on the grounds that he wouldn't be allowed to speak.
Well, it's fair enough, isn't it? I mean, you've got the leader of the country. If he was to go to Waitangi, then you'd expect that he'd speak on behalf of the country at Waitangi. I think he's made a reasonable decision. He's decided to attend events in Auckland instead. I don't have the exact program of what he's doing in Auckland in front of me, but I understand it's going to be visiting local iwi in Auckland and celebrating Waitangi Day for the day that it is, a celebration of New Zealand's history and New Zealand's future. And whilst it would have been good to go to Waitangi and for him to speak on the marae, there's been some decisions taken which hasn't allowed that to happen. But Deputy Prime Minister Paula Bennett is going to the dawn ceremony on Waitangi Day up in the upper marae in Waitangi in any case.
Ngāpuhi leaders have since apologised and re-invited Bill English back to the treaty grounds, saying that he would be able to speak. Do you believe that he should go back?
I think if Ngāpuhi can make arrangements and ensure that there's a real opportunity for the Prime Minister to speak in the future, that probably could be on the cards. But look, last year there was a lot of problems. This year there've been difficulties in securing a position. You can't guarantee that one decision that's issued one day isn't going to change. We need some more stability up there. But more importantly, the Prime Minister of New Zealand should be doing what most New Zealanders are doing, and that's celebrating the day that Waitangi is, and he's going to be doing that in Auckland.
Do you think maybe he was a little afraid of flying dildos?
Oh, I think the protesters have probably learnt not to do that in the future.
Brilliant. All right, well, thanks so much for that, Jamie Lee. Really do appreciate your time. Have a good rest of your day.
Thanks, Jamie Lee. I'll talk to you next week.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Jamie Lee Ross, a National MP, talking to us about Bill English not attending Waitangi Day ceremonies and his first trip overseas as Prime Minister, and inequality after the Oxfam report that was released this week. After the break, we'll have politics and law professor Andrew Geddes from the University of Otago talking about Trump's inauguration tomorrow. Yes, tomorrow it's really happening.
If you're in the business of fashionista-fying yourself, Recycle Boutique has the duds to get you looking styling no matter the season. With three convenient locations, they've got you sorted for formal wears, casual streetwear, imported American vintage, and all the designer brands you thirst after. Plus, you can clear out your closet, and Recycle Boutique will sell your glad rags on your behalf, freshening up your wardrobe and earning you a bit of ding on the side. Recycle Boutique, Newmarket, in the CBD, Takapuna, and online at recycleboutique.co.nz.
Where are we?
I think you mean, when are we? But also I think you mean, where are we? Because we're in Japan, but we're also in the distant past.
Wow.
This is the very day young Rick Breeze witnessed a powerful spring wind carrying cherry blossom petals in such a beauteous way that his weather obsession was born. Look, there he is! Pass me the camera!
Right, oh, yeah.
There's no memory card in this.
You told me to bring a camera. You didn't say anything about a memory card.
God damn it. Oh, crap, he's seen us.
Disney.
Oh, I'm so freaking shamed by you.
Shut up.
Spring is here, so it's time to spring forward into a decent weather forecast. Catch Rick Breeze, the captain of the cold front, every morning on breakfast, where he'll rain down meteorological insights. Rick Breeze and the BFM Weather Report, every morning on breakfast with updates throughout the day. Proudly brought to you by Pro Gear, professional photographics. They've got the cameras and accoutrements to make all your shots primo. Check them out at progear.co.nz.
The Wire.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
Sorry, I hadn't heard that sting before. That's brilliant. You're back on The Wire with John Michael Swanix and Amanda Robinson. We've had heaps of feedback coming through on the text line. Thanks so much for that. Once we find one without any swear words, we'll definitely read it out for you. next up, we have Andrew Geddes, who's a University of Otago law professor and politics professor. This time tomorrow, Donald Trump will be president of the United States. Yes, tomorrow. Some aren't particularly optimistic.
Listen, sweetheart, I'm about to be president. We're all going to die. Next question.
Gotta love some SNL. Anyway, I spoke to Andrew Geddes about what we can expect in the coming days, months, and years. Donald Trump's being sworn in tomorrow. He's got a Senate full of Republicans, a majority in the House as well. He's also got to appoint a nominee to the Supreme Court. What limitations does he have on his power?
There's a couple of limitations. The first one is, even though the Republicans do have majorities in the Senate, for a lot of things to be done in the Senate, a bare majority is not enough. You actually need a filibuster-proof majority of 60. The Republicans just have 51 seats out of the 100, so they've got a bare majority. That means that the Democrats can still block some measures in the Senate. One thing in particular they could block are nominations that Trump has made to his cabinet. So there are still things the Democrats can do. The second thing that may be a bit of a block on Trump is the fact that while there are Republican majorities, a lot of the Republican Party don't actually like Trump. Remember, he was fighting his own party as much as he was the Democrats in the lead-up to the election. And so there's no guarantee that the things Trump wants to do will actually be accepted by the Republicans in the House or the Senate. They've got their own interests, they've got their own agendas, they've got their own policies. So it'll be interesting to see how much Trump can work with nominally his own party on these sorts of issues.
Is there any candidates that Trump has put forward that the Democrats are likely to block?
There's some that look like they might have a few problems. The education secretary is one that people have been looking very much askance at. She's had some interesting views on gay rights issues. She's also a big fan of private schooling, and the Democrats may feel that's someone they're not too happy with. The other one who is facing some issues is the nomination for Secretary of State. Interestingly, it's not so much the Democrats that are the problem there as the fact that one of the key Republicans on the committee that's scrutinizing is Marco Rubio, who, of course, was Trump's opponent in the primaries, and Trump was extraordinarily rude about, you know, called him Little Marco and called him a liar and sweaty and things like that. Rubio has expressed a lot of concern that Trump's candidate for Secretary of State is too close to Russia, and, you know, indicating maybe he will block that nomination. Now, of course, that may be a bit of payback. You know, Trump needs him now, and so Rubio may be saying, well, you know, I'm going to pay you back. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Absolutely. And in terms of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, that's a big one that Republicans are very focused on repealing. Trump, in the campaign, he promised to repeal and replace. How likely is it that that will be possible under a Trump administration? What obstacles are there there?
Well, first of all, there's no obstacle to getting rid of it now. The obstacle to getting rid of it in the past was that Obama was vetoing any moves in the Congress to get rid of it. Of course, now they've got a Republican president. That seems to be a problem. What the issue is going to be is what you replace it with, because you've got a lot of people who actually, you know, got health insurance under Obamacare, and a lot of the people who got health insurance were low-income Americans who, you know, voted for Trump. So if they get rid of Obamacare without something in its place, the people who voted for Trump are the ones who are primarily going to be hurt. So the Republicans, now they're governing, now it's not enough just to say no. They actually have to have something positive. And what that positive step will be, no one really seems to know at the moment. The proposals that have been put up would mean, you know, millions of Americans would lose health insurance. So that's what they have to do. I'd imagine they will get rid of Obamacare and replace it with something that may actually look a little bit like what they had, but they'll now call it Trump Care, and so, you know, everyone will be happy.
Do you believe that Obama's legacy will live on in a form of Trump care?
Yeah, I mean, they can't go back to what they had before, which was a disaster. I mean, the reason that they passed Obamacare in the first place is that you just had millions of Americans who had no health insurance, which meant if they got sick, they either had to go to hospital emergency rooms and you'll crowd out the system and cause big problems there, or they just got no health care. And you know, that was just intolerable. It just, you know, Americans just weren't standing for it. So healthcare is something that there has to be some form of government provision of healthcare in the U.S. Or some way of intervening in the healthcare market to allow people to get healthcare. Now, what exactly it looks like, you know, is still a bit up in the air. Remember, Obamacare actually came from the Heritage Foundation, which is a very right-wing think tank in America. So originally it was a Republican idea. It should have been something they were very happy with, but because it had Obama's name on it, they just opposed it. Now, that's the sort of ridiculous level that politics in America has got to.
What can we expect from tomorrow onwards?
Interesting times, I think, is the short answer. I mean, no one really knows. If Trump governs like he twitters, it's going to be a disaster. But, of course, no one really knows whether Trump's as crazy as he appears on the surface, or whether he's just going to take a back seat, be kind of turn up to the big rallies and enjoy the pomp and ceremony and let other people get on with actually running the country. It was suggested during the campaign that he got Mike Pence, his vice president, on board by saying to Mike Pence, look, you can run the show. I'm just interested in the, you know, being the front man. So if that happens, well, then we'll get a more right-wing America with, you know, a lot of Republican pro-market ideas running the country. We'll have a very different international regime where, you know, America tries to throw its weight around a bit more. But, you know, in the end, they're controlled by domestic politics. Trump actually lost the popular vote. He only barely scraped through in the Electoral College. He's not actually that popular. So his ability to completely rework the country, you know, it's pretty limited.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
That was Andrew Geddes from the University of Otago on what we can expect following Donald Trump's inauguration as US president tomorrow. We've also received a few texts about what we've been talking about over the past half an hour or so. So at the beginning of the show today, we had an interview play from our reporter Lillian Hanley with Mount Albert by-election socialist candidate Joe Carolyn, and a texter who didn't leave their name on the text said, "Your speaker now on the need for more left politics has a very clear view of the problem. Middle class politicians aren't addressing our real issues." And in regards to our interview and weekly chat with National MP Jamie Lee Ross, Peter said, "It's too easy to relinquish your own freedom. Voting for the left makes it a certainty. Why would you? Cheers, Peter. More freedom, less government."
Good old Peter. He's a regular texter.
Hi, Peter. Shout out to Peter. Trump tomorrow. How are you feeling, John Michael?
Slightly scared, apocalyptic. I actually had to go to bed very early the night of Trump's election, and I was hoping that I was going to wake up and it had all been a bad dream. Still in the bad dream.
I think, yeah, everyone deals with that. Like, I had to watch everything and look at every tweet and see everything about the election to kind of process that. But it's terrifying,
I think,
really.
Joe, who was the interviewee we had earlier, the socialist candidate for Mount Albert, he made an interesting point about how a lot of people in America and around the world are turning to far right candidates instead of the far left, because the far right are stirring up hatred, you know, of minorities, of gay people. They're, you know, finding scapegoats rather than, you know, voting for their own economic interests. I thought that was a really interesting point that he made. But it all kind of, especially in the US, it all kind of comes down to race relations. You know, we heard in that interview just now with Andrew Geddes about how the Republicans hated Obamacare because it had Obama's name on it, when they should have actually been very happy with it because it came from a right-wing think tank.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's so much literature and so much, you know, research that's gone into just how divided America is and how much their race relations have to progress before, you know, they can actually move forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking about kind of voting against your own interests, I don't even think it's just economic interests. Like, one of the second largest, except for white men, to voting bloc to vote for Trump was like middle class white women. So that's voting for their interests, upholding that kind of privilege, rather than voting for their interests kind of as women, with women's rights, reproductive justice, of all course. That kind
and
of thing.
There's all those women's marches. There's a lot of liberal women, obviously, who are furious about Donald Trump. And there's a lot of them happening on their Saturday, so it'll be our Sunday. But tomorrow, I understand there's some protests as well.
So around the world tomorrow, I think there's something like 300 countries are partaking in it. It's mainly centered around the Women's March on Washington. So women, like every kind of woman, is marching in Washington and around the world in these kind of sister marches to kind of protest Donald Trump and his administration. So if you want to head down to the one in Auckland tomorrow, it's at 10:30 until 12:30 outside the US consulate. So that's on Customs Street, and that'll be marching to Myers Park via going up Queen Street and just making as much noise and resistance to that as possible. And if you can't make it to that, a bunch of mainly US-based activists, Black Lives Matter movement coordinators, have created a resistance manual. So that's resistancemanual.org, and that's kind of looking at how people can take action against the Trump administration to do with health, immigration, incarceration, LGBTQ equality, women's rights and reproductive justice, the Muslim ban and registry, the climate, environment. There's so many things that Trump's administration is kind of getting wrong that people want to resist against. So resistancemanual.org is the place to go to find out all that kind of information. Next up, SET is a teacher's council journal with a new issue focusing on civic citizenship and political literacy in education. The journal critiques what type of civic knowledge and citizenship is currently being taught and asks whose citizenship and what values are prioritised. I spoke to one of the contributors, Josiah Tuala-Mali'i, of the Pacific Youth Leadership and Transformation Initiative, about this journal and the piece he co-authored. I began by asking how these topics are currently taught in New Zealand.
The first thing is it's not all taught the same way. Each school or community who teach this type of education do it however they like, but that's not always the best way. And so this journal is sort of a collection of some ways it's being taught well across cultures and with different spins on it so that it's relevant to each community, different communities across New Zealand. So we're just trying to help educate teachers and busy school leaders, give them some more resources so they can be better prepared when they're coming up with new ways to teach this type of education.
And the piece that you co-authored is called The Next Step in the Journey, and that focuses on the Pacific Youth Leadership and Transformation Council. What's the kind of role of that council?
In 2010, the Pacific Community in Christchurch created Pilot, and the idea was that there wasn't a strong Pacific youth voice in our region. And so to grow that, we've turned ourselves into a charity and we advocate for Pacific young people to participate in democracy. And basically that's just in order to increase their advocacy and to have Pacific young people engaged in democracy.
You wrote that in Aotearoa we often speak about equality for all and everyone having the right to speak their views. How is that different to the way speaking is approached in Pacific communities?
Across the different Pacific cultures, it's different. But in a Samoan perspective, there are some young people who get opportunities to speak, and that's because they're being prepared to be future leaders. But equally, there's not always a leadership role for everyone. So someone might play a different sort of leadership role in the background, and in that sense, they might not have that development around speaking in public or being able to address a group. Rather, they're doing something else, and that all adds to the wider community's wellness and success, but it's just not in a verbal way. And so the reason we mention that is so in a community context, one approach won't work for everyone in a Pacific community. That's what we're trying to say.
The council's flagship project is iSpeak. Are you able to talk a little bit about that program?
Yeah, so iSpeak is basically a debate that we run, which is tailored so that when Pacific young people come along and listen to a particular issue, immediately they're interested. Because, I mean, youth in general, you know, sometimes if it's not spun a particular way, it's not made to be engaging, or they can't see how it connects to their own lives. a particular issue like deep sea oil drilling or the living wage, us fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, they might not understand why it's relevant to them or might feel too big or too far away. And we say, no, as a Pacific young person, you have a stake in what's going on in New Zealand. You have a stake in what's going on in this issue. And through the debate, really short debate of 15 minutes, they can have full background to the topic. Then they can hear two sides of the argument, ask some questions, develop their own opinion. And then our trust helps pull that information together. And then we take their voice and give it directly to decision makers. And probably the bit that we love about it most is that we then ask the decision makers for a response, and we hold them to that until they've finally given us one. And we got one last year from Drew Brownlee, which was really cool, about us in ISIS, in ISIL. And just the way that he methodically responded to every point they made, ended up being about 3 or 4 pages, they felt really empowered and like government had actually heard them. Even if he might have disagreed with particular points they made, he was listening.
That's so important as well to hear that. So lastly, what do you hope to see in the future for education around civic citizenship and political literacy?
The big thing all the authors want to see is more young people who want to participate in our democracy, but that our educational leaders are changing the way they're teaching so that that happens. And iSpeak and other ways that we talk about in the journal, great ideas that we'd love to see others pick up. They're published there because we want to share them. And if anyone would like to contact us or talk more about it, please check out Pilot on Facebook or Twitter. We're really happy to help, and I know that other authors are too. We just want to see a New Zealand where there's no barrier to political or democratic participation.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
That was SET Journal contributor Josiah Tuala-Mali'i talking about civic citizenship and political literacy in education. After the break, Australian correspondent Jordan Curtis will come with Neighbourhood Watch talking about Centrelink debt recovery, a government travel entitlement scandal that's very interesting, and Vegemite returning to Australia. You'll hear all that after this song.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We'd like to welcome you here to the Dance Pavilion up at Lake Arrowhead. To really kick off this swinging summer, from Reprise Records, we bring to you Mr. Personality himself, Donnybrook.
For you, it waits on DVD and Blu-ray. The Neon Demon.
I see 20 or 30 girls come in here every day from small towns with big dreams. Some girls crack under the pressure.
The latest piece of stunning psychological horror from the visionary director of Drive, Nicholas Winding Refn. Elle Fanning stars in this chilling, sensual film set in the cutthroat world of modeling.
You know what my mother used to call me? Dangerous. You're a dangerous girl.
The Neon Demon, out now on DVD and Blu-ray thanks to Madman.
Hi, you've reached Telekiwi Nesis, New Zealand's number one psychic hotline. Please hold the line for your specially selected clairvoyant.
Hello, this is Susan. What can I foresee for you?
Hi, I was hoping you could tell me what the traffic is going to be like on New North Road this afternoon.
Right, let me just see. Okay. Ooh, it's not looking good.
Really? Your psychic powers are telling you that?
My psychic powers? Dude, you're driving a car in Auckland. Of course you're going to get stuck in traffic.
There are easier ways to get the juice on your forthcoming traffic woes, the best being the 95BFM traffic report. Every weekday on Breakfast and Drive, we'll let you know which streets are arse to ankle and which roads are flowing free. The 95BFM traffic report, proudly brought to you by Scootling, your key to unparalleled freedom with a range of style and scooters and mopeds to ease all your congestion woes. Visit them at 310 Great North Road and online at scootling.co.nz, the spiritual homeland of city movement.
Next up, we don't have Neighbourhood Watch. That'll be coming a little bit later. But we have journalist and producer Muhammad Hassan talking about New Zealand's complicated relationship with Israel.
So this resolution is really not a surprise in itself. There's been many resolutions that have been critical of the Israeli settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. The majority of the world recognizes these settlements and the construction of these settlements as illegal. And that's primarily because they are being set up in military-occupied territories, which are, you know, the Palestinian territories, the West Bank in particular, as well as East Jerusalem. Under international law, they're recognized as occupied territories. And so there's a lot of arguments and that a lot of countries support that under the Fourth Geneva Convention, you are not allowed to dispossess people that are in occupied territories, and you're not allowed to demolish houses or buildings, and you certainly aren't allowed to build new ones. And so this resolution kind of came after a 40-year deadlock where a lot of countries have been trying to pass resolutions that have been critical of the state of Israel, especially their settlement construction, and the US has repeatedly vetoed it. And so what's happened this time is that the United States, under the Obama administration, decided that they were going to abstain from the vote and not veto it, essentially giving way for it to pass. And it passed with a 14-0 vote, so almost unanimously, apart from the U.S. who abstained.
Right. And what were the main countries involved in the resolution?
So this resolution was initially put forward by the Egyptian government under President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. And very quickly, you know, within the last month or so before it was about to go to vote, a lot of things happened. And these included the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who has a good relationship with the Egyptian president, contacting him and telling him, you need to hold off on this, you can't go ahead. At the same time, there were reports that President-elect Donald Trump called the president of Egypt and told him, you need to hold off until I'm in office and I want to deal with this. And then so there's been speculation about whether the pressure was used. Egypt is the second biggest recipient of military aid from the United States after Israel, and so that could have been a factor as well. But what happened was is that Egypt backed off on the resolution and said that they were going to wait for the new administration in the U.S. to deal with it. What happened then is that New Zealand, alongside a few countries, so Senegal, Malaysia, and Venezuela, decided that they were going to push this resolution forward, and they co-sponsored it. And that's why it went before the United Nations, before the Security Council, a month before Obama was about to leave office, but also a month before New Zealand's temporary seat was about to expire.
Right, and Foreign Minister Murray McCulley has like an interesting relationship with this resolution. Are you able to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, it's not this particular resolution, but New Zealand has been on the Security Council for 2 years. So we had a 2-year temporary term. And right at the start, in January last year, Murray McCulley spoke in front of the United Nations, and he was very critical of the way things were done. He said that there was a that the United Nations essentially was acting in favor of peace, or like, you know, keeping the peace at the cost of conflict-led resolution. And he cited the Israel-Palestine conflict as a primary example of that. And he said that throughout the 2-year term that New Zealand was going to be in the Security Council, one of their top priorities was trying to get those sides back onto the negotiation table. And negotiations have been stalled for some years now. And so this resolution really was the final opportunity for New Zealand to do something about Israel and to do something about Israeli settlements that Murray McCulley has been very critical of.
Right. And so Netanyahu then said that would be, if they voted for that would be a declaration of war.
Right.
What kind of action did Israel take in the days following that?
So interestingly enough, that comment was actually made via phone. So Benjamin Netanyahu, a few hours before the vote took place, called up Foreign Minister Murray McCulley and pretty much told him that you can't go ahead with this. If you do this, this is an open declaration of war. And it was, it's a very, very dramatic statement.
Yeah.
And you can think about whether or not, you know, what the logistics of going to war with Israel, a country that's, you know, thousands of kilometers away, are. But what happened in the direct aftermath of that is that the Israeli ambassador to New Zealand was recalled, and our own ambassador to Israel was pretty much told to leave, pack his stuff up and leave. And so diplomatic ties were cut completely. The other country that suffered as well was Senegal, because it's the only other country. So Venezuela and Malaysia have no diplomatic ties with Israel. But Senegal, which was a recipient of aid from the government of Israel, that aid has been cut completely. And within the last few days, Benjamin Netanyahu has said that he's going to cut some of the funding that goes from the Israeli government to the UN, which is about $6 million. So clearly, you know, the tensions are still there.
Yeah.
And it's only, you know, it's going to be uncertain about how the relationship between New Zealand and Israel is going to be mended in the near future.
Yeah, absolutely. And you also said that this isn't the first time New Zealand's gotten Israel's bad books. Are you able to talk about that kind of history of that?
So diplomatically, the two countries have had quite a colorful history over the last 12 years. And it started off actually in reverse. So back in 2004, there were two Israeli citizens that were captured trying to falsify passports, and they were using the identity of a man with cerebral palsy to try and kind of make fake documents, and it caused a massive row. So Helen Clark, the prime minister at the time, accused Israel of sending spies. Israel said that they weren't spies, they were just Israeli citizens. We ended up cutting ties with them for about a year. And eventually things were mended over, but the Israeli government never admitted that they were Mossad agents. So that was in 2004. Fast forward to 2011, and directly after the Christchurch earthquakes, there were three Israeli citizens that were, three Israeli nationals that were killed in the quakes. And there was an investigation that was done by the Southland Times that said that that the three of them, or at least one of them, was an Israeli agent, and that he was carrying 5 fake passports on him, and he was here as part of an international ring of spies that Israel was sending. The report itself was pretty much shut down by the government, by the Jonki government, although the Jonki said that the citizens and their identities were investigated by the SAS, and nothing ended up becoming of it. So that didn't actually change the diplomatic waters between New Zealand and Israel. But a few years later, in 2015, New Zealand, and this is, you know, in the Security Council, tried to pass a resolution about the Israeli settlements. And this one was actually a lot more critical of the Palestinians than the one that was just passed. So it wanted a complete halt of settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. But at the same time, it wanted the Palestinian authorities to stop their attempts at going to the International Criminal Court, which is key here because now that's been left open. And so what happened when New Zealand tried to sponsor this bill is that the Israeli government kicked out our ambassador again as a pretty much a warning that New Zealand shouldn't go down this path and that this isn't something that Israel wants one of its allies to be engaged in.
Oof. So yeah. Long, complex history. Eh?
It is a long, complex history. And even away from the diplomatic world, there's been a lot of activity going on between the two countries in terms of activism. So,
right.
The organization Kiora Gaza has sent eight envoys to the Gaza Strip in particular for a number of years, and it took part in breaking the siege of the Gaza Strip through Egypt or through international waters. They also took part in the aid flotillas that were highly controversial. Last year there were two journalists from Māori Television as well as Green MP Marama Davidson who were detained on their way to in one of these eight flotillas that was trying to cross through international waters. So, you know, it's been a mixed bag, but New Zealand has definitely been on Israel's radar for some time.
Yeah, absolutely. And now with the inauguration of President-elect Donald Trump tomorrow, terrifying times, really. But once he officially takes office, I mean, he has a definite certain stance on the UN and on Israel, both of those. What are we likely to see occur in Israel and the UN under Trump government?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty, I think, with the Trump administration. There's a lot of things that he said that he's going to do and that we're just going to have to wait and see whether it actually happens. And one of these things was he threatened to defund the United Nations. And that would be a serious move if one of the veto members decides to take such a drastic stance. But also he's been critical of the EU, and the EU have been very critical of Israeli settlements. He said that he's going to be the most pro-Israeli president ever. What that actually means, I don't know, but it does kind of cast a shadow on the role that the U.S. has been playing in being a broker in negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Remains to be seen how it affects the relationship between New Zealand and the United States, which is kind of on murky waters already because of the TPP, which Trump is against, and because of, you know, the relationship between New Zealand and China, who's our biggest trading partner, who aren't exactly on the best of terms with Donald Trump. He's called them out repeatedly, and he's threatened to change the way that trade is happening between the two countries. So certainly, it remains to be seen how all of these different players decide to act, you know, in the coming years. And, you know, as of today, diplomatic ties are still to be restored between the New Zealand government and the Israeli government.
So around, you know, up to
8,000 or 10,000.
Shit. The Wire.
That was Radio New Zealand journalist and producer Mohammed Hassan talking about New Zealand's complicated relationship with Israel after New Zealand's recent UN vote was called a declaration of war by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Now we have Australian correspondent Jordan Curtis with all the latest in Australian news for Neighbourhood Watch.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
Beginning sometime last year, I think it was about 6 months ago, the Australian government decided to transfer that debt recovery scheme for Centrelink, which is pretty much Australia's face for social services, transfer that onto an automated system. And then since then, thousands of people have received notifications about debt which they didn't actually have. And in order to not receive fines or other punishment, they had to prove to Centrelink that Centrelink actually got it all wrong. And so what happens is that the system compares Centrelink's data to that of the Australian Tax Office in order to find discrepancies. And it's been very efficient at finding a lot of discrepancies, even ones that may or may not be there. Of course, as many Australians would expect of Centrelink, they haven't been extremely helpful with dealing with the situation. In fact, Human Services Minister Alan Tudge has been pretty adamant that there's nothing wrong with the system, but rather that people complaining about debt that they really do have. But there has been cases of people who didn't realise that they would be getting debt, but they just assume that Centrelink knows what they're doing, and so they start paying it back. As more and more people come out saying that they have received a debt which they shouldn't have, they've noticed that a lot more people have come out of the woodwork denying that they actually owe you the money. And there's some cases where people are being fined, being overdue with a debt, and these are people who are currently on welfare or disability pensions from Centrelink, and they're under threat of having their services cut off if they don't keep paying the fines for the debt, even though they may not actually have actually had the debt to begin with.
Oof, what a mess. What is kind of the way out of that?
At the moment, the government has finally caved into public pressure to try and fix what's wrong with the system. Because apparently before the system was put in place, the automated system, it was all done by humans, and it was a lot slower. And then over 2010 and 2013, when it was all human, there were about 1 million discrepancies found while doing the same thing as the automated system is doing now, with around 85% resulting in a debt of $1,400 on average. But since then, the number has increased a hell of a lot. The government knew this would happen as well. There was a review of a pilot program of the automated system sometime last year, which found that with less human oversight, if it was all automated, there would be issues like this popping up, but they just decided to ignore that because there was the potential to make more money.
The next story that we have is about a government travel entitlement scandal. What's that all about?
Yeah, this one has been one of the more entertaining stories over the summer, because sometime over the Christmas break, now ex-Health Minister Susan Ley really put her foot in it. She was discovered to have been spending a lot more money on her travel expenses than other ministers, and she'd been spending a lot of time doing government business, which is the qualifier for being able to claim it on the government's entitlement fund, to go to the Gold Coast. And she ended up being apparently going to the Gold Coast more times just by herself than any other minister in her party. So she first got in trouble because she was chartering flights, private flights, instead of taking commercial flights. But her claims for that was that the commercial flights wouldn't have gotten to where she wanted to go on time. But sort of checked out. But after that, people started looking to what she was spending her money on. And so in some cases, she had chartered a flight for herself to pilot in order to be able to keep her pilot's license. And so instead of spending $200 on a commercial flight, she'd be flying her own plane for $12,000 because I think she needs at least 90 hours per year in order to keep her pilot's license. And then on top of that, it was on one of her government trips, she had an impromptu purchase of an $800,000 apartment, which really raised some alarms, because when you're on government on a government-funded trip, you're just meant to be doing government business. And this really made it look like she was abusing the system to take care of personal business while on the trip. Then other reports have come out saying that she had spent other times in Queensland looking at other properties, and which sort of gave up the goose that this wasn't a one-off thing. She actually did put some thought into it, took time out of her busy schedule to go buy this apartment. Rightly so, she's eventually lost her position over this. She stood down, which is politician for she got kicked out. But so it's really caught up with her, because it seemed like every day there was new information coming out on this story, and it was just that hole was getting deeper and deeper for Susan Ley. It was just crazy. And that she's been taken down. There's also other ministers who have been dragged through the mud as well.
Our last story for today, Vegemite returns to Australia.
Yeah, so back in the 1930s, following the death of the creator of Vegemite, Fred Walker, his company got picked up by Kraft Foods, which he had a running partnership with during his career. And so since then, it's been bounced around some multinational companies. But finally, Bega, a dairy company in Australia, has decided to fork out the money to buy most of Mondelez International's Australian New Zealand grocery and cheese business, which means that Vegemite, among other products like peanut paste, will be coming back to Australian hands, which has gotten a lot of people very excited.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for Friday the 20th of January. Thank you to everyone who came on the show. We had Socialist candidate Joe Carolan, National MP Jamie Lee Ross, Set Journal contributor Josiah Tuala-Malii, Radio Adelaide's Jordan Curtis, and journalist and producer Mohammed Hassan. Also, a big thank you to producer John Michael Swanix and
very welcome.
News director Shamina Smith. Murray's up next with your 1 to 3. I'm Amanda Robinson.
And I'm John Michael Swanix.
Have Good a lovely afternoon.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.